talk to Gary about that.
No, I'll be there, well, I'll do whatever's necessary.
Paul said it has to order about 1:35 on the 6th of March. All committee members are here, Senators Olson, Green, Elkins, Wilkins, and myself, Dyson. And we have three bills for us today, HB 109, screening for a new bid and hearing, SB 8, nurse education loan repayment, and SB 184, mental health patient rights. And we'll take them in that order. So, let's see, who's going to present HB 109? This bill's sponsor is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm delighted to be here before the committee, and I thank you for your patience. And I have learned to pay great deference to the Alaska State Senate. But having said that, I'm going to excuse myself in a couple of minutes because we're participating in a very compelling hearing up in a joint house finance and resource meeting with Daniel Johnston. He's brilliant. That being said, I'm going to leave this to Jane Pearson, who has done just an extraordinary effort on fleshing out the concerns of this issue in a moment. I'll just make a basic introduction. Each year in Alaska, we have about 10,000 live births, and 30 to 40 of these children are born with some degree of congenital birth defect. Oftentimes, this birth defect is not identified until the kids are 2 to 3 years of age. At that time, the children have lost a lot of their cognitive skills, and they also have experienced oftentimes some degree of speech impediment from a poor development of their jaw muscles. As such, not only do we have the intangible issues that come when any born Alaskan suffers, but as they enter our school system, K through 12, then they become a considerable liability to the state of Alaska as well. And so we have several issues that I've been particularly sensitive as I have kind of watched this bill develop. There certainly are the intangible things, which is we'd hate to see any degree of suffering with our young. On the cost side, we've got the issue of whether this is a health mandate. And we are requiring insurance companies or the state to provide for the cost of this test. And then we have the economic benefit that accrues to the state of Alaska and its education system. I have seen a figure that suggests that the burden to put a child through our special education programs, K through 12, can range up to $400,000 per child, which means that the burden per child that is born with an unidentified partial or complete hearing loss that's not identified at some point in time where we can reverse the damage to that child can be as much as $12 million per year. Secondly, we have work to try and get a hearing loss test included in the birthing package in much the same way that with a lot of automobiles that you purchase today that automatic door locks or automatic window controls come with the vehicle as part of the standard package. And that is the way that we have approached this, and I believe that you'll hear testimony from Blue Cross and Blue Shield, who are not the exclusive health providers for the state of Alaska. In my private sector job, I use principles, so I'm a fine example of another company. But the cost was so incidental for them that their greater concern was that it would be included in the birthing package in such a way that they wouldn't have to send a supplemental instruction booklet to the members who enjoy health care benefits, that would be more expensive for them than to include the hearing test in the birthing package. I think this is a worthwhile bill to get a hearing and to consider for this year. A lot of good ideas take a lot of time, and I'm delighted that today we'll get fair hearing on this bill and be able to contemplate it. And so with that, and with respect for the committee's time, I think I will defer to Jane Pearson and let her and other folks that know far more about this issue testify on it. And I thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for your patience and for hearing this bill today. I appreciate it.
Yes, Senator Dyson. My name is Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Jay Ramirez, and whatever questions you have.
Questions for Jay?
Yeah, I have a question.
Senator Green.
In just reviewing the legislation, it's only a little part of it has to do with what happens to an infant in the first 30 days. Why have you added on the creating a whole new ledger in the Department of Health and Social Services? Why does it suddenly become the state's responsibility to track and define and implement treatment? And I'm not sure what the degree is, but that looks like a huge, huge issue that implies that at some point it's going to be the state's responsibility.
Representative Green, what the bill does would be a follow-up program. If a child was found to be with a hearing loss in the first test, they would be sent for a follow-up test. If they were still found that there is a hearing loss, then what would happen is they would be referred to programs within their community, and they would be put into the infant tracking program, which would basically follow their progress until 3 years of age.
And it stops there?
Representative Green, through the chair, yes, it stops at 3 years of age. And Representative Green, what we found out talking to parents and various people who have children with hearing losses is that even finding that their child suffers from a congenital hearing defect, that there was still that whole, where do I go from here? And this would be a system that would be implemented as to where do you go from here.
But this goes much further. I mean, the state becomes an active solicitor. The department shall conduct a community outreach to inform medical providers, pregnant women, families of newborns, and it bothers me that it's the state doing this, and that's my concern. It's not that I don't think it's necessary. We've had the hearing and, speech programs for children in schools for years. Granted, it's, begins at about three, but I'm concerned that we have giving way too much oversight and authority to the state for furthering the interest of what should be a family decision.
Representative Green, at any time the family could opt out of this program, that is part of the bill. And I think that the state, it's a system to be implemented as to how to follow up and track these children. And Stephanie Birch is online, and she could probably give you more information on that, too.
Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Wilkins.
Thank you. Jane, I'm referring to this chart here, and we've heard a lot about this, and the sense is that we don't do this today, but the newborn screening, but the chart would tell you that we do. So just kind of follow up on what you had said to Senator Green. What does the legislation bring to enhance what we're already doing?
Senator Wilkin, through the chair, what the legislation would do is provide a follow-up program to the initial hearing screening. It would provide a follow-up hearing screening, and it would also be informative as to bringing what programs are within the community and a link to the mm-hmm. community, as well as to other programs available to children with hearing disabilities.
I don't know how it's done in other towns, but I spent 9 years on Alaska Crippled Children and Adults Board back in the, before I got this temporary part-time job, and I remember that the ACCA would reach out to our hospitals and our clinics, and we had a very robust infant and youth hearing program, and we were always looking for audiologists to help us. So would this legislation, would it just add another layer of bureaucracy, or are there places in the state that don't have some sort of a network or a fabric to follow up once it's being done by these different locations?
Senator Wilkins, through the chair, it would provide uniformity throughout the state. I think there are better volunteer programs in certain parts of the states than there are in others. I think this program would also work hand in hand with the programs that are out there.
Well, do you have a sense that there are, again, back to this, are there facilities or hospitals in the state that would diagnose a newborn that has a hearing deficiency and that would be the last, there wouldn't be a follow-on to that?
Senator Wilkins, through the chair, I do not believe so. I believe they would try to follow up with
that. Okay. Yeah. All right, thanks. Thanks, Jane.
Jane, I'm impressed with the fiscal note. I'm impressed with how low it is, and I'm impressed that somebody thinks that all of this, but not only the testing, but the information program, which is really a good thing to do, plus the tracking and so on, can get done for $64,000. Is that what I'm reading? Can you help me understand that near marvelous number?
Senator Dyson, that near marvelous number, and I'm sure you're referring to the previous fiscal notes that have been on this bill, is because the actual machinery has been is now in place throughout the state. The actual hearing
test
machinery is now in place throughout the state. All the birthing centers, the hospitals have this. Also, the state has it so that they can move it into villages and whatnot. So we're no longer talking about you have to go out and purchase a piece of equipment that's going to run, $20,000 per piece of equipment plus. So that's basically why the note is down.
Okay, but the idea that we can do all this awareness, education stuff, and the tracking for the $64,000, so I'm impressed. Does that seem like an appropriate number for you? To you,
Senator Dyson, through the chair. It does seem appropriate, considering if there are still federal grants. If you can look at the breakdown on page 2 and 3 of the fiscal note,
uh-huh.
You can see where the various, monies are being spent. And the plan for the development of this program.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
I have a question.
Senator Green.
Is there, and I don't know if the department has anyone here or not, but is there anything that would prevent Health and Social Services from preparing a brochure that went out and was distributed in each hospital?
I believe Stephanie Birch is online, Senator Green, and she could probably help you with that. I do not believe there would be anything that, would prevent it at all.
Why don't you stay there, and we'll talk to Stephanie. Stephanie, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you, Senator Dyson.
I was just wondering if there's anything that would prevent the department at this time and place to prepare an information brochure to be passed out in offices and our hospitals or birthing centers to talk about hearing loss and newborn screening.
Senator Green, through the chair, first let me introduce myself. I'm Stephanie Birch. I'm the section chief for Women's, Children's, and Family Health, Division of Public Health. And this is one of the programs I'm responsible for, and in fact, I've been responsible for the last. We've been fortunate enough, I just want to give you a little bit of background if you'll bear with me. We've been fortunate enough to be funded a second round of funding now. It will be a total of 8 years of funding that have allowed us to establish an infrastructure for this particular program, which is supported as a standard of care through the American Academy of Pediatrics and Maternal Child Health Bureau. That funding has allowed us to create a tremendously robust series of informational brochures that start out with sort of a general information brochure, which we've just been dispersing for well over probably 4 years now. And then as a family potentially would go through the system of having a child who would be referred on for diagnostics and then potentially would be diagnosed with a hearing loss or deafness, there's a whole series of materials that have been produced for that seem to would be materials that we would not have to necessarily do a tremendous amount of updating on, and would, and thus the production cost would be fairly minimal. So I think that answers your question right now. In fact, we do disperse that. It's all of the hospitals, the 23 hospitals that deliver babies, and all of the communities that deliver babies have those brochures pretty much at hand. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay.
Stephanie, Ms. Dyson, in my conversations, Dr. Monsager, as I remember, he was really in favor of us extending the screening to all the infants and the kids in the state. And I remember him saying that we are already screening for 60 or 70 different things. Do I have that number right?
Senator Dyson, yes. This program is actually an adjunct to the newborn metabolic screening program, which is currently in statute. And that newborn metabolic screening, typically it's called the PKU test. It's where a newborn has poked and a sample of blood is taken. We're actually screening for over 36 metabolic disorders. So we have a reporting mechanism already in place where we already know about basically all the kids that are born. Newborn hearing screening, quite honestly, is or newborn deafness, congenital hearing loss, is actually more commonly occurring in newborns than, in fact, any of the other newborn metabolic disorders. And we know just from statistically that we probably should be seeing around 30 kids a year that are born with some level of hard of hearing or deafness. Our desire then is to sort of set up a program that mirrors this, just like we're doing for other congenital defects. Catch these kids when they're early and screen them. And in fact, we are successfully screening and getting results on about over 80% of the children in the state. That I should mention probably includes just about all of the Medicaid children. I know there were concerns about this program would add additional costs to our, you know, acknowledged large Medicaid budget. But in fact, I'm quite confident that the majority of children who are already eligible for Medicaid are currently being born in hospitals, so we are most likely catching all of those kids. The children that we have not successfully been able to bring into the program are children who are born out of hospital. In fact, we're working with the direct entry midwives on establishing systems for referral, children who are born at home, and then children who are born in hospitals where there's a high turnover of staff, and that in fact, because this program's not required or mandated, it sort of becomes a program that perhaps has not had as much attention paid to it. So our desire to have mandatory legislation around this program is really to establish it as a program that mirrors our newborn metabolic screening program.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. So this is in essence fair to say we're not really establishing a whole new bureaucracy to track this, but adding one more condition kind of to an existing screening and tracking program?
That is absolutely correct, Senator Dyson. I think we've done a marvelous job establishing a system. What makes this unique, and the reason why we are hoping for legislation around this, is to really establish knowledge around the kids who have. As you can well imagine, when a family, typically the kids who are more at risk for hearing loss are children who have been born in the intensive care unit or exposed to a number of different disorders while the mother was pregnant. And so their hearing loss may not be recognizable right at birth. And so we want to be able to track those children who are more at high risk for developing hearing loss, as well as be able to assist those families who are identified. The system, as much as we've tried to simplify it, and this program will allow us to provide just a little bit of resources, as you'll notice, you know, work with those relationships, but it's really to help families navigate the system, be presented with the menu of choices, including deaf education, as well as any sort of audiological treatment, if in fact the parents desire, but at least to know what their choices are, what seems to make most financial sense for them, what makes the most sense for them in terms of where they live, what resources are available for them, and connect those children with an early intervention program in their community to enable them to at least have access to some sort of language development, be it deaf education, sign language, see sign, hearing aids, cochlear implants, whatever seems to fit the best with the family and the child's needs. Thereby, have them that much farther ahead for when they start school. We know that there's been an interesting study done by a gentleman from the Federal Reserve Bank out of Minneapolis who looked at the cost, the advantages of having children in early intervention and early education. And there are two studies that were actually just completed and were presented to the rest of the Federal Bank Reserve members, and he found that the investment in resources paid off 7-to-1 to 20-to-1 in the gains that occurred as a result of children being able to be better employed and better educated later on in life. So those are the gains that we're really trying to make on here, to invest a little bit at the beginning to help them establish language means of communication for when they're starting school and to be that much farther ahead as they progress through their preschool and childhood years through 12th grade.
All right. Thank you. I think you've gone a little bit beyond answering my question and are doing a marvelous job of advocating for what we're here to consider. Stephanie, would it be fair to say that the passage of this bill won't make any more remedial services available to children and parents, but in fact help them find out about the disability and the places they can go to get help?
And I promise to be brief. Yes, I think that the passage of this bill will help with those connections. The fiscal note that you do see does add some resources to the early intervention program to increase as the numbers of children that we identify increases solely for the hearing resources consultant. There's a specialized consultant that works with families as children identified as deaf or hard of hearing. And right now they only have 1 to 1.5 FTEs dedicated for that effort. She's only able to handle 35 children or so that's in the entire state. So as we know, as we identify more children, more resources would be needed for that consultation.
All right, thank you, that's helpful. Other questions for Stephanie? Senator Olson.
Thank you, and I'm not sure who to ask this question of, but maybe it's the sponsor. What has been the rural hospital response to this proposed legislation?
Stephanie, this is Jane. Can you answer that?
Yes, I can. Thank you. Senator Olson, through the chair, the response has really been outstanding, you know, considering their significant changes of staff. And that's why I think this legislation would be really helpful in establishing this as a priority for the hospitals, which they do need to really try to prioritize what work that they're going to do. But all of the rural hospitals have really come along. They've found a manner of purchasing equipment, or we've placed equipment in the community. And so they actually have done a very nice job participating with us.
So if I call Kanakanak or Samuel Simmons, they'll say that they wholeheartedly embrace this new mandate?
Yeah, and in fact, up at Samuel Simmons, actually the community, I believe it was the Lions Club, got together and purchased equipment for that particular hospital, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct, actually. Mr. Chairman, just one last thing. I think it's for the sponsor. It says it mandates that this screening be done. What are the penalties for not complying with the mandate?
Senator Olson, through the chair.
Are there any penalties, first of all, for something like this, when you think of the population that you're dealing with?
No, sir, there are not. It is referred to.
So, Stephanie, what happens, is Dyson, what happens with this or other kinds of screening if the medical providers don't comply?
Well, you know, the power of persuasion and doing the right thing in terms of what the community standard is seems to have served us well, Senator Dyson. For the newborn metabolic program, when a couple of us started working on that, particularly the newborn metabolic screening coordinator took over, we had a number of physicians who had erroneous information which prompted them to not be very participative. But we, I think, were able to provide them with good scientific research and shared with them what the standard of care is and what the standards are around American Academy of Pediatrics. And we found that that was generally compelling enough that they came in line. And so now we have just about 100%, or we have had 100% compliance by all of the physicians. To date, we've really had very little resistance and, in fact, quite a bit of cooperation and activist work on the part of nutritionists to participate in their communities.
Any further questions?
Yeah.
Senator Green.
Stephanie, very often we've seen in the past when government of a state has been involved in diagnosing or keeping records and statistical data on a group of people with whatever kind of disease or symptoms or what's come out from a test. And the next thing you find out is a state and advocates say, oh, we cannot possibly diagnose this and not provide the treatment and not the follow-up care. And for instance, the person who lives remote and for whom there are no audiologists, there are no speech therapists, there are no hearing assistance providers. And the next request is, well, if we only had transportation back and forth to Anchorage so that we could see the providers. That concerns me a little bit, the way this language has been drafted. Do you see that happening?
Through the chair, Senator Green, I can understand what your concern is. We actually are very fortunate to have a fair number of pediatric audiologists that are part of the Native community, that are part of the Native health system. And in fact, I think a couple of them are online to share with you what their experience has been. They actually travel out to the villages to do the hearing screening and follow-up. There, you are correct that there are times when we need to bring children in for a screening exam or for a diagnostic exam and or treatment. But generally, once the family's decided in terms of what their method of communication is going to be, the ongoing follow-up is not necessarily taxing to the system. And I think we've been fairly successful keeping transportation costs, as we've been in this program for the last 4 years, providing audiological services to children, particularly those who are Medicaid beneficiaries, and not really to be cost prohibitive.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions, committee, at this point? All right. I've got quite a number of folks who have signed up to testify, and we sure want to hear from you in light of the number of people and other business we've got before us. I'd encourage you to keep your testimony as concise as you can so that everybody gets to speak to us. And if a point has already been well made by a previous person, I would encourage you to respect that and probably plan on the fact that we heard it from the first person. But we want to give you all a chance to testify. I want to go first to the Barrow LIO, Lena Ongley. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
We got you loud and clear. Please give us your testimony.
Excuse me, sir. I thought I heard echo. Yeah, there was a little bit of an echo.
Yeah, please.
All right,
please give us your testimony, okay. Lena.
Well, I'll just try to put echo. I work up here as sleep event specialist in the North Pole. I've been here for several years. I have a master's degree in early childhood education, and I have a clinical competence certificate in both audiology and speech language pathology from American Speech and Hearing Association. And I'm not going to belabor the point of how important it is to diagnose hearing impairment early. I think we already covered that quite thoroughly. I want to comment on the fact that, statistically we have about 30 children born with sensory neural hearing impairment or deafness in Alaska in a given year, and that number sounds quite small and insignificant. However, the hearing impairment, there's also another type which comes as a result of frequent ear infections. And to be able to refer to a normal newborn hearing screening result when evaluating children for hearing loss associated with this middle ear fluid later on, it provides clinically important data for me as an audiologist to talk about a change in the child's hearing, and also it is a reality check for the parent, because when they were told when the child was born that the baby's hearing was fine, and now when I'm testing the baby at 6 months and they've had 5 ear infections and the hearing is no longer okay, it's a reality issue, and that baseline data provided, it helps the parents understand how important it is to get timely medical evaluation at this point. Because the program data from my experience up here on the slope, it indicates that in many villages, 5 out of 10 children have chronic ear pathology accompanied by mild to moderate, about that 40 dB hearing loss, when they turn 1. So this is a significant issue, and the most long-term serious consequence, of course, of these types of ear infections is the language delay, which goes undiagnosed when the hearing is not periodically followed and monitored. This, of course, this long-term hearing loss like this even can contribute to difficulty to learning to read and write. And it's quite curious that up here with the North Slope schools, they also report that only about half of their high school graduates can read and write at grade level. It corresponds very well to that early diagnostic data that we have collected.
Can you summarize, Lena? Can you summarize, please?
That's about the whole summary. It's very important to have the early diagnostic evaluation and the periodic monitoring. I know it sounds like it's costly. However, long-term costs are even greater when it goes undiagnosed, because we have the data. Children do not learn to read and write.
Thank you, and thank you for the work you're doing. Are there questions for Lena? Thank you. We'll go now to Fairbanks, Carrie Pippin.
Hi, this is Carrie Pippin. I'm a speech therapist here, and I work in the school district as well as working at the Alaska Center for Children and Adults. And I have been fortunate to work mostly with hearing impaired kids in the schools, and I just wanted to encourage you to go ahead and do this follow-up, because often hearing impairment is considered an invisible disability. Parents will say, oh, they respond to a loud noise, so they can hear me, but the children aren't hearing the more quiet sounds, and so they tend to miss a lot of information, missing vocabulary and language and things like that. So I would just encourage you to do the follow-up program so that parents really can take seriously from the medical aspect that their children do have a disability and it needs to be followed up on, because the implications for them in the school and their success there is great.
All right. Thank you, Carrie. Any questions for Carrie? Thank you, and thanks for the work you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Go now to Daniel Knitson. Can you hear us, Daniel? Daniel Knitson on a telephone connection.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Got you loud and clear. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Dyson, and good afternoon, Senator. My name is Daniel Knudsen. I am an audiologist here in Juneau, and I've been a member of the Early Hearing Detection and Intervention Program since its inception, and then previous to that, it was the Universal Limited Hearing Screening Task Force. I'm not going to reiterate what Stephanie clarified so well. Basically, my concerns were that you folks were having some concerns with Section 5 of HB 109, and I kind of wanted to further explain those. You probably received my letters here over the past couple weeks regarding that section, but I think Stephanie explained that pretty well. What I do want to say is that I do think this legislation is very important in the fact that if we have this mandate, as Stephanie indicated, as staff changes so quickly, especially in the rural hospitals, we don't want to see these programs suddenly just get dropped. And if we have this legislation as law, it will ensure that you know, we have equity across the state, across all of the hospitals, and that none of these programs will they'll all continue to go on. Coming from Nome, I was director of audiology up at Nortonstown Health Corporation at the time that we initiated our program. And we decided the only way to, you know, recoup the cost of the screenings was to wrap it up into the daily maternity rate, since there were no CPT codes that existed for screening at that time. So, you know, the cost of it's fairly nominal when we do take a look at the overall cost of missing a baby and not picking them up until they hit Head Start age. So, and that's, you know, there again, it's just reiterating what's already said. So in the interest of time, I won't go on any further. I think it's really necessary that we have this law simply so that we do have equity across the state regarding, you know, provision of services and keeping this program going.
All right. Any questions for Daniel? Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dyson.
All right. Now we've got an even dozen more people who want to testify, six here and six in Anchorage. So what I'm going to do is alternate back and forth. So Pamela Mueller-Guy.
Hi, my name is Pam Mueller-Guy. My parents didn't know that I was deaf till I was two. She thought that, oh, it means nothing at first. I'm calling names, not years, fast. And then my grandma said, better check it out. So we had to drive 100 miles down to the specialist who's sick. I have profound nerve deafness. By the time I went to speak, 2.5, quick, do something about this. And then 3.5, remaining. And then later on, 6 grain, went back to an allergist for sicker. found this one more annoying. It's a severe, profound deafness for me, both you names. I'm bad because I'm not useful. And on school, no sign or learn to talk takes time. Not perfect speech, but still mean practice going. But I do like sign because of background, teleconference, and years, and relax. So I notice in here that a lot of times when people saw deaf or sign around this era, they asked me if there's any deaf community here. I said, yeah. Someone told me there's no deaf here. I thought, really? That's why they left, because they didn't want to stay here, because no help. So it's important to have programs, something like that. It's really important. And I'm doing support for myself, and I do support for my work, Sam. We're trying to let them know there is sign interpreting available here. And I do support helping, giving information. Because I remember my mom, a long time ago, not much information, you know. She had to write a letter to John Tracy Cleaning, California, get some help for information. So I think it's very important to have boosters, the booster, to make sure to find quickly so they have a better chance. Because I've noticed a lot of people don't have not chance to succeed. So that's why I would like to say profession cost effective. Early detection will provide a child with opportunity to learn intellect. Communication so that can grow up and contribute to its community like others. Early information and information to Sire's family goes a long way in helping the Sire to get access to service. It's less expensive than waiting until the person is undocked in the folk rehab system for the first time. So I would like to see that pass. Because I know that we can see like hearing people. Thank you.
All right, Suzanne Rust in Anchorage. Next will be Jody. Suzanne Rust in Anchorage, can you hear us? Can't hear you. Watch the mute button or get closer to the mic. Yeah, I got you now, Jody. Go ahead.
Okay, this is actually Dan Ross in Anchorage.
Okay. I'm sorry, yes. Sorry. I got confused. Go ahead, Susan.
Okay, well, thank you so much for scheduling this call. I can start with telling you that my name is Suzanne Ross. My daughter, I have three children. My daughter is now two. She's actually in the room. So you might hear a few little people remark, but she was identified at Providence for the newborn hearing screening. I have two other children. We have no hearing loss in our family. I got a referral. I got a little purple sheet of paper, and they said, oh, it's fluid in her eustachian tube. Most likely, call this number. So that's a hospital. I remember calling, and I actually very clearly remember a moment of time when I thought, gosh, my daughter doesn't have hearing loss. I can tell she's hearing me. And I actually thought about not following up. I have a master's degree. It was a momentary thought, but thank God I did follow up. After that point, I was lost. I had a really difficult time making it through the process because her hearing loss was not straightforward. And so I kind of flailed about by myself. And it was scary at times. I mean, it took us 3 months of doing something every single week to nail down that she did have a hearing loss. So at 3 months, she was aided. And I remember walking out with these two little hearing aids and being so very thankful that I knew she could hear me. I would say that she says, "I love you" now. She's 2 years old. She's speaking. She's using sentences. We're seeing a speech pathologist that we've intervened early. I work with her on her language. And I have no reason to not believe that she won't attend a regular school and have a wonderful life ahead of her. I want to really stress that I was lost, and that the tracking, I think, is an important component of this bill, because birth to 6 months is a crucial window. And if we miss that window, it's really impossible to catch children up. And it's the most common birth, and I don't like to say defect, but birth issue in the U.S. And so the other thing I want to stress is that there are many states who have already passed this legislation. I was reading a list, and what I thought about when I was reading the list of Oklahoma and Alabama and da-da-da-da was that we're either going to do it today, and it can be on your watch, or we can do it in the future. And how sad I would be as a mother to think that perhaps living out someplace that doesn't do a good job of hearing screening, and that they miss my child. So I really do encourage you to pass this bill. I think it's really important. And I have to say that we will be saving school district money. And there will be other children, just like my daughter, who are very fortunate. I have nothing to gain from supporting this bill. I'm just very blessed. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there a question for Suzanne? All right. Come back here to Anchorage. Jody.
Hi, my name is Jody Rump. I just represent myself. My son was one of those that was missed. He was 8. He was born here at home, home birth here in Juneau. There was no newborn hearing screening machine, so we didn't have that baseline. We then moved out to a small fish cannery called Excursion Inlet, which has a population of 10 during the winter. We had no services. I knew his language was delayed. I didn't know why. Turns out there was many factors. By the time we did manage to get him a hearing test, it was inconclusive. They didn't know what was going on. We didn't have that baseline from the newborn hearing screening to tell us that, hey, he could hear at one point. So we ended up having to be flown down to Seattle, which is quite expensive, for a very invasive bear test, which determined that he could hear but had some middle ear fluid problems that we were then able to take care of. His language was delayed. We also found out he had some other cognitive issues that we're still dealing with him. When I think of the time he missed hearing that maybe he could have heard, I wonder if he might not be more caught up today than he currently is. He's 8 now. He's just at my last school thing. He's now 8. He's just barely caught up on speech and language, which is a huge accomplishment for him and us. But the school district and Medicaid has paid for many, many, many years of speech and language therapy for my son. I would wish that that would not happen to anyone else, especially in the rural communities where we are more able to be forgotten. The public health nurse comes by the small community I live in once a year. I know that they now have these testing machines. So there has been a lot of progress since even my son being born 8 years ago. But I would like to see this bill so that that progress is not lost. As these machines age, eventually they will need to be replaced. My fear is that without a mandate, that as they age, that this program could be dropped in certain communities and children will be missed.
Thank you. Senator Green.
Is it your understanding in this bill that you would have been covered by this process?
It is my understanding that if he had gotten the newborn hearing test, we would have had the baseline saying that he could hear. And that when he later had a hearing loss, we could have more easily determined that it wasn't a
No, I was just wondering, because the language here talks about children born in hospital, and you said yours was a home birth.
Mine was a home birth. I know.
I'm not criticizing Homeburst, don't get me wrong. I'm just trying to figure out, because this is a fairly limited in scope.
It is. What it does do, though, is it standardizes it. So the public health nurses that do go out to the smaller communities would be required to test the children in those communities as they go through those communities. So there is more occasionally home births out in the communities where they don't always immediately go into the hospital. There's been several, even in my little community, and it's important for the public health nurses to come through and to do the testing at their earliest convenience. And if that's just once a year, that's better than not catching them at all. My main concern is, as the great equipment that we've gotten all these wonderful grants to install over the state starts to age, as we have the staff turnover, that this program may fall apart. And the last thing I want to see is a program that's shaping up really well right now. We've got those nice TV spots with the governor on them, and the information is getting out there through the infant learning program. I just don't want to see it stop. One way I can see of keeping this going is to have some legislation to make sure that it stays where it is and hopefully improves.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Any questions for Chairman? Yes.
Yeah.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rum, thanks for coming out. You certainly give us a different perspective, and one that I would like to explore a little bit more. One is that you were dealing with a home birth, which there are, and as well as some of the difficulties that go along with travel, trying to get to a medical center for the testing that's done, whether it's a bear test or one of these photoacoustic emission tests. If someone is not Medicaid eligible and lives out in rural Alaska, and they have home births, let's see, up out of Ambler for some reason, got to go to Kotzebue for that. How can I appreciate what they've got to spend to get their children in there, realizing that they're not Medicaid eligible?
It's having children is expensive. And there comes a point where families just grit and bear it. You do it even though you don't have the money to do it, because this is your kid. And that is what you do. And there's been times where we've been very in debt, when there's been things that either Medicaid wasn't covered or we weren't Medicaid eligible. Like currently, we're no longer on Medicaid and we take care of all of our bills on our own. It is a huge expense to travel. I like that the public health nurses do have these machines and are making those small village hop visits with the newborn hearing testing. If we are detected, the parents will have to pay for the travel into the state. It is a huge financial burden, and that's true, but when you're a parent, you do it. You take a mortgage, I beg, borrowed from friends, parents, and they were all very kind to assist us, but it is a huge burden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Jody. Go to Anchorage, Lisa Owens.
Learning was a struggle for me, as I was unable to hear instructors and had to ask repeatedly to have things explained to me. I could not hear my friends who were trying to help me. It made learning and living very, very difficult. Had I been diagnosed earlier and put my hearing aids earlier, I believe that my life, both in school and outside, would have been much easier. The need for early detection of possible hearing loss can greatly help children. If parents and teachers were made aware of problems with a child, they can compensate so that learning is individualized, making the child feel included, not special or different, thereby providing them with an environment that will help them more efficiently. Having hearing loss detected at birth would increase the chances that a child can get the help they need so they do not lag in school and life. I cannot stress how important early detection of hearing loss can be. You know, you can't make the hearing come back, but you can get hearing aids and teach children. As a child, I felt so different and so alone because I could not understand what was going on around me. When I did get hearing aids, it was at a point where they did nothing but confuse me because I had been used to hearing one way, and suddenly I was overwhelmed by the new sound. Had I gotten them earlier, my perception of the sound and hearing would have been something that I could have adjusted to easier, and it would have made my chances of learning and understanding that much better. Getting the hearing aids at an early age allows for adjusting to new sounds and being accustomed to them. I hope that you truly consider making the training of hearing a mandatory requirement from birth onward. Give the children a fighting chance to do the best that they can in school and in life. Every hour, day, minute that is wasted not screening a child is pushing that child's learning back further. I treasure the sense that I hear. Give newborns that opportunity as well. And I just wanted to say that we were just in a conference back in Houston on Washington, D.C., and 38 states have legislation now, with several other states pending. And I believe it's just a matter of time that all states will require this, and I really hope that we are not one of the last states. Thank you.
Thank you. And Lisa, would you tell the staff there to see what they can do about the echo on the...
I think they're working on it right now.
Sounds like they... Good. Thank you. Thank you. We'll go now to Sandy Fricke.
Hi. Hi, I'm Sandy Fricke. I am a nurse at Bartlett Hospital. I have been a nurse in the maternal child health division in the OB department for the last 30... We won't go how many years. Anyhow, the last 3 years, we've been very blessed here in Bartlett to have had the newborn hearing screening. It is not difficult to do. We have incorporated it right along with our PKU testing. So it's a very easy thing to do. I mean, if babies cooperate. Sometimes newborns have some fluid in the ear that you have to kind of wait 24 hours to let it drain out or repeat in another week or 10 days. But generally, we have been very successful at getting the hearing screens done in a very expedient manner. I also went up to Anchorage for training last April and am currently one of the persons who will put all of the hearing screen results on the State of Alaska website so that they can track them just like they do all the PKU results. And I've also been responsible for sending out letters to parents, like when our screener has gone down and we've had, you know, problems not being able to do them, to remind these parents to please bring their children back in for screening. We also have instituted a program here at the hospital where if a baby refers, we do two hearing screens while they're inpatients at the hospital. If a baby refers on one or both ears, we make sure that the doctor's office gets a special report to their office stamped in red so they can see it, telling them that they need to have this child rescreened in, you know, 1 to 2 weeks as a reminder. Then they would be coming back to our institution, having the hearing screen done, and then I would be putting those new results in the database in Anchorage. We do service many people. We get home delivery people coming in when the providers have told them about, you know, the hearing screening that Bartlett does. We've also had birthing center clients that have come in, and we do them, and I enter their results. We've had people from Gus Davis and out in other communities that have come in and had their hearing screens done. I do not have any idea where the child may have been born. That isn't my concern. I don't care if they have insurance. I mean, that's not one of my concerns. We do it at this time with no cost, is my understanding. They're just brought in it so that we get it done. We really could benefit from some, you know, financial backing, but my concern is patient care, not payment at this point in my career, because I'm very concerned that everybody gets the screening and has an equal opportunity for a productive life.
Is it fair to say, Sandy, that passing this bill won't change your activities? You'll just keep on doing what you're doing.
I'm still going to keep on doing it, but I would hope that it becomes mandatory and that people realize how necessary. I mean, PKU is mandatory. Unfortunately, we do have a few parents who do refuse hearing screening, as they also refuse PKU testing or immunizations, much to the detriment of their child's health.
Other questions for Sandy? Senator Elton.
Mr. Chair, Sandy, thanks for your testimony. And the one you mentioned, the birthing center and people from out of town also, you didn't mention home birth, but I'm assuming that
yes,
they would be covered also.
Yes, we do have home birth. If the home birth attendant tells them, you know, to go in, I'm not sure exactly where those people get their PKU testing done, but, you know, they are responsible for making sure they get the PKU testing done, and I would hope that the home birth providers are telling them about coming to Bartlett for a home screening. Because we do have the ability here. I'm not sure whether the public health nurses in Bartlett or in Juneau go at, have the screeners to go out, because we do have a native screener at the hospital.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Next here, Catherine Price Carter, you'll come up. And but while you're coming, I'm going to we'll get Martin Beals in Anchorage. Can you hear us, Martin?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yeah. We can only hear one of you. That's wonderful.
Wonderful. My name is Martin Beals. I am the chapter champion representing the Alaska chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Chapter champion in this means for the early detection hearing program. Of course, the American Academy of Pediatrics has had strong positions on many topics, including involving childhood health and safety. And to my knowledge, this is the only time they've decided to appoint a chapter champion in each state. And I think the reason is not that they care more about this issue than some of these other issues, such as car seat safety and bicycle helmets and school health and nutrition, but simply that this may be a difficult issue to wrap all of our minds around. Certainly in pediatrics, there's a lot of different things that we have to learn about what to do with the child who fails the first screen, fails the second screen, is referred for the diagnostic component that we call the bear, and then what our job might be in looking at the genetic, early intervention component that we want to help these parents get through. So if you're having a little problem getting your mind around all of this, I think it's that we realize at the American Academy of Pediatrics that this is not a simple situation as just we administer something in the newborn period and it's either positive or negative, like say a strep throat test might be. Screening tests are meant to be over-diagnosing conditions initially, and therefore having a lot of what we call false positives. These false positives have to be further updated as to their accuracy by repeat screen. If you don't realize that it's possible that these could be true positives, meaning that the child really is deaf, the child doesn't come back for follow-up, it gets lost, and even though we might do the test in the newborn period, that child may not get any services until they show up much later, maybe at the age of 3, which is the average age of diagnosing children with hearing loss prior to the introduction of these programs. I think other people have discussed some of the issues that have been brought up as far as why call this a mandate? Well, we're asking each hospital to do it. We're not asking each parent that they have to do it. I think very few parents would refuse to allow their child to have their hearing tested, but we want the hospitals to get involved with this. Somebody was bringing up home birth. I know in Anchorage, the patients that I've become involved with who have had home birth, I have arranged for them to get hearing tested at our local hospitals, and I've had no problems getting that done at this point. The American Academy does endorse not just the early screening, but the entire package this bill would offer, and I hope that you consider passing this bill today.
The questions for Martin? Thank you for your testimony, sir, and for the work you're doing. Come back here to Catherine.
Yes, and thank you for allowing me to speak today. I don't really have any new information to add, and I'm certainly not an expert on the statistics for the state of Alaska, but I do have to say that as a nurse, and all of the nurses at the Bartlett Hospital strongly support the program and would like to see this become mandatory simply because it adds more legitimacy to the program. If we say that the state of Alaska and the health department for the state of Alaska is behind us in our desire to screen all newborns, 100% of all newborns, I believe the parents will consider that more credible than just our opinion alone. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for the work you do. You. Questions? In Anchorage, Mark Butler. Beverly Smith.
I put a no down.
Okay. Then Marie.
Mark in Anchorage.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. Please give us your testimony.
Thank you. This is Mark Butler. I'm the Public Information Officer for the Anchorage Department of Health and Human Services. Beverly Woolley, our director, is in emergency operations planning training today and could not come. I will shorten her comments because I've heard it all said previously that we are very much enthusiastically in support of this bill. We greatly appreciate Senator Dyson, you chair, having this in your committee and hearing it. We know you're extremely busy there, and we wish you Godspeed on those other issues, but this is an important one as well. I don't have anything else to say that someone else hasn't more eloquently said. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mark. Questions? Thank you. Marie.
My name is Marie Darlin, and I'm the AARP coordinator for the Capital City Task Force in Juneau. And you already have a letter of support on this bill from us. Just wanted to remind you that once again, we are not only a senior or retiree organization, but we're maybe the biggest bunch of grandparents available and working very hard at being grandparents. AARP members, of which in Alaska there are roughly about 84,000 of them, were not fortunate enough when we were born to be screened for hearing disabilities, and yet we know there are many, many of our seniors who have hearing problems. And so we just feel that this is very important for this next generation coming up to actually have this opportunity and would like to see this bill actually become law.
Thank you. Any questions for Marie? Thank you for helping us. Susan Walker in Anchorage. Susan Walker in Anchorage. Or Debbie Golden.
However, my son's loss, being as profound as it is, we identified it at 6 months, and were able to then get appropriate intervention. And it was pretty intense for the first probably 4 or 5 years. However, he went into kindergarten with all his normal hearing scares, and is now in fifth grade at his local elementary school and doing great. And I'm really here just to reiterate how important screening is initially, because children have to be identified, but how important the whole process of screening, the evaluation and diagnostics, the tracking and the intervention are, and making sure that children are identified, that they are kept on track, and that they are given the opportunity to be exposed to language and to hear the sound. And that they can really maximize that input and just do exceptionally well. And I just request everybody's support for the bill. And I think that the long-term implications of it are nothing but positive ones. So I really do encourage you all to hospital. And I won't go into any more detail. I just submit email letters to you all last week. So I hope to have had an opportunity to read those. Thank you.
And thank you. Other questions for Susan? All right, the last person we have signed up is Debbie Golden in Anchorage. Can you hear us, Debbie?
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to be here and testify today. I really would love so much to repeat everything everybody has already said, just because I think it's so important. But I will cut to the chase and tear my comments down. I work for the Alaska chapter of the March of Dimes. I'm director of program services there. I'm a 26-year resident of the state of Alaska and have been a registered nurse for 24 years. Prior to working for March of Dimes, I worked as a public health nurse in Alaska for 15 years and have seen how health service systems, healthcare systems operate in Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, and Anchorage. I think it goes without saying that March of Dimes is strongly supportive of mandatory newborn hearing screening. Experts have been emphasizing the value of determining hearing loss at an early age for the past 50 years. So I won't reiterate along those lines. What I want to say is that I believe the beauty in this bill lies in its simplicity. House Bill 109 simply will assure the good things we have in place to address newborn hearing loss won't go away. It's not about building complex new systems because the early hearing diagnosis and intervention program is in place. It's not about burdening rural healthcare providers with new duties because they already have the equipment and conduct hearing screening. And it's not about making Medicaid or private insurance companies pay for expensive new services because they've been covering the small costs associated with newborn hearing screening since 1998 and intend to continue covering them. House Bill 109 simply will ensure that we can maintain the effective program that we already have, that we can screening babies all over the state. Sorry about that. That babies won't, the screening that's occurring all over the state already will not go by the wayside because of new duties being added or because of staff turnover. And it will assure that new insurance companies that may enter the scene will adhere to standards. In addition, House Bill 109 will prevent children from falling between the cracks. Newborns will be less likely to be missed being screened, and children will be less likely to have delayed intervention or be lost to follow-up. We choose to protect children and promote their health in many ways, and we know infants benefit from having hearing loss identified. I hope that all of you will agree that we don't want to deprive Alaska and its newborns from the benefits that are associated with House Bill 109. Thank you very much for passing this bill out of the House today, your committee, the Senate House Committee today. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie, and we do have a letter from you, and thanks for the work that the March of Dimes do. Any questions for Debbie? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Golden, thanks for speaking to us today. Obviously, you've got a fair amount of responsibility as well as experience in your 24 years of serving as a nurse. And you say you've been involved, I'm not sure how long, with the public health aspect of it. Obviously, with the degree, I guess my real question has to do with how often do you expect that these results are coming out, going to be coming out with false positives, since there's a fair amount of concern related to that, and the, I guess, the expense of having to go ahead and get a second opinion on it.
Right. You know, I couldn't really speak to the incidence of false positives.
I don't know if Stephanie may have data as to false positive. I haven't really, you know, on my end here. Oh, okay. Excuse me. Somebody just handed me that there's a 3-4% referral rate. And what exactly does that mean, Carrie? Okay, so apparently 3-4% of kids who do test positive. Can I defer the answer of that question to Carrie Chera?
Yes, sure.
Thank you. So my name is Carrie Chera. I am the manager of the state early hearing detection intervention program. My background is medical speech pathology and audiology, and I'm here just to provide some data. And what I'm trying to present is that for the infants that receive newborn hearing screening, approximately 3-4% of those screens will not pass the screening. This does not necessarily mean that they have a hearing loss, but that they need to be checked again to see if there is something that needs to be looked into further for medical care. It's at that point when they get the additional testing that they would find out if they were a false positive or not.
Senator Olson, to follow up.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. On this, I guess the question I had for Ms. Golden is not so much what the overall referral rate was. When you have an audiologist versus a public health nurse testing, what type of false positives do you get?
Oh, I see. You're asking if there's a difference, say, between an infant that maybe is tested by a public health nurse in the rural parts of the state versus being tested somewhere else?
Either that or being tested by an audiologist that brings one of the acoustic emitters or the brainstem response machines out to the village.
Okay. Well, there's apparently the number of kids who don't, or the percentage of kids that don't pass the screening test is the same regardless of whether the child is tested by a public health nurse in a village or tested by an audiologist in some other location.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks for helping us. All right. I think that's the end of the public hearing. Discussion? The will of the committee? Mr. Elton?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd move committee substitute for House Bill 109 and the attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing none, it passes. Thank you. We'll now take up SB 8.
I'm not sure they made a case for that bill.
Nurse Education Loan Repayment Program. See the sponsors here. Ably assisted.
Downstream impacts.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time to hear this bill. Senate Bill 8 is designed to help stem the shortage of nurses here in the state of Alaska by setting up a tuition loan reimbursement program. The mechanism is fairly simple. It's a bill that this committee actually heard in an earlier iteration a couple of years ago. The idea is to allow nurses who go to work in the state of Alaska who have outstanding student loans to get up to $2,000 per year of their student loans repaid by the state as a stimulus, if you will, to fill the positions that are missing now in the workforce. We estimate there's somewhere between a 9-11% shortage of nurses statewide right now. We believe that shortage is worse in rural Alaska than it is in urban Alaska, although we understand that some of the most critical shortages, if you will, are in hospitals where emergency room nurses, critical care nurses, and nurses for small babies are perhaps most notable. That is, the shortages there are harming our citizens. The Department of Commerce, the Alaska Department of Commerce, expects that the nursing shortage will continue into the future, that there will be an extraordinary amount of growth in this area, that there may be upwards of 4,000 new nursing positions needed in the state between now and the year 2010. And so it's for those reasons that we bring you this bill, to try to do something to make certain that we have qualified individuals filling positions here in the state of Alaska. The fact that this is a nationwide shortage, I think, speaks to the need to have some kind of stimulus here in the state so that we continue to attract not only individuals to fill the positions, but qualified individuals, the best individuals. And that's certainly one of the reasons why we're here today. The basic idea is a workforce development idea to attract the best, to put the best to work in the state, and to allow these positions to get filled. The UAA has done some work in this area. They've expanded their nursing program. They're graduating about 215 nurses per year now. However, that's about half, I think, of the workforce expansion that the fiscal note points out and that the Department of Commerce refers to. So that's the sum and substance of the bill. I'm here with my staffer, Allison Biostock, who is the staffer in my office assigned to this bill, and we'd be happy to answer your questions.
Yeah, thank you, Senator French. Have you looked at the fiscal note?
I have, Senator, and I agree it's a daunting amount of money. There's a couple of responses. One, the program could be configured to fit a number more appropriate for what the building will support. Two, it's a small price to pay to have a strongly staffed hospital in every city and where necessary in the bush.
Yeah, I appreciate that. As those are people are preparing the fiscal note, do you think they took the worst case, like everyone who might be eligible?
That's probably a
take
question.
Advantage of it?
That's probably a question better directed at that individual. I would point out that there's at least, I think, one assumption there that I took issue with, and that's the growth rate assumption. It caused me some concern because it really the growth rate assumption is the workforce growth rate at 3% a year, which struck me as being low, frankly. If you look at the numbers in the Department of Commerce, if you look at their own numbers for new hires, if you assume a workforce size of 5,500 and workforce growth at 3%, that's about 150 jobs per year, which I think is not accurate. I'm not certain where that number came from. I was just doing some math in the back of the room, and it came to my eye, and so I'll just point that out to you, as I'm sure the members of finance would pick up on it either sooner or later.
Thank you. Other questions for the sponsor? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator French, as we're looking at the fiscal note on it, and certainly the numbers there do catch your attention, have you looked at a comparative cost if we don't attract the nurses to the program, or don't attract nurses to the state of Alaska, what it's going to go ahead and cost us, both in overtime as well as the inability to provide services on from the state level?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it's certainly a point that's well made and well intentioned. I can't give you a number, but that's obviously a competing cost that you will incur should you not make certain that we have an adequate staff of nurses statewide.
Just make a note. Go ahead.
Well, the traveling nurses are one good example, as I'm sure you're well familiar with, Senator Olson, that when you bring a traveling nurse to your locality, you're paying an extraordinary amount of extra money beyond what you're actually getting in wages for hours worked, just for the presence of that person who was only going to be in your community for a short time.
If I can make a point, Mr. Chairman, I locum tenens certainly is an expensive way to go, but I know that there was a situation there in Nome where there was a shortage of nurses, so the nurses went to a critical state where the nurses actually shut the hospital down, and we were medevacking all our patients down into Anchorage that required any kind of inpatient care. Just a comment.
Thank you. Other questions for the sponsor at this point? Senator Wilken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator French, you know, this is really a wonderful idea, and I really appreciate the intent and the message that it sends, but there's always the buts. Those that ignore history are doomed to repeat it, and back in the early 90s, this program, our student loan program was bleeding general fund money to the tune of tens of millions a year, and so the legislature in the mid-90s just said enough is enough. We need to get it on a self-paying basis, and we have, and in fact, they're giving us money back now. And one of the ways they did that was to get rid of that concept of loan forgiveness for all sorts of folks. And so that was a critical component in making this program healthy and self-sustaining. So we come to today, and today we're suggested that nurses this applies to nurses, okay, but my problem then is next year it's going to be teachers, and the next year it's going to be EMS, and the next year, and the next year, and the next year. Pretty soon we're back to a program that's struggling because we're giving away the service, and we'll have a program that today has the lowest student loan interest rates in the nation. To spread across to all Alaskans, to one that'll be more expensive. There's no way to make it up. So while the message here is good and the intent is good, I just think we're starting down the proverbial slippery slope, and we're going to end up right where we were in the early 90s. And 10 years from now, some group will be sitting here talking about why the student loan program is so expensive. And one of the reasons will be because we're giving up a lot. We're giving away our services. There's other ways that we can put an incentive out there for nurses and teachers, and we've done some of that through low or no interest housing. There's other ways to do it, and I would hope that we can do that in some other manner. But to give away the services of our student loan program, I just can't support. I think we're starting a precedent that we're not going to be able to stop.
Okay. We'll go to some folks who signed up to testify. Patricia Center in Anchorage, can you hear us, Patricia?
Yes, I have a bit of a frog here. I hope you can hear me. I'm Patricia Center. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Alaska Nurses Association, and we were certainly very pleased to see that Senate Bill 8 was being brought up back up for hearing. Senator French attached to the bill today for you some information on the nursing shortage that is several years old. Several of the things have changed since that data was used, and as we said, the University of Alaska is now producing about 215 graduates per year. One thing that hasn't changed, and which just is evident from the testimony you received on the bill before this, is that the average age of nurses has not shifted much. I think it's now around age 48. So we are trying to encourage younger people go into the profession of nursing, and we're also trying to encourage them to stay in the profession of nursing. Often in the first 2 years after graduation, the reality of how difficult a profession this is hits students, and then they drop out, and we would like them to stay on, and maybe once they feel that there is some reward for them staying in the profession, things will level out and they'll be more accustomed to it. Certainly a tuition loan reimbursement would be such an incentive to have them stay. I wanted to bring up, I just saw the fiscal note today for the first time, so first of all, I don't think that 70% of the new hires will have qualifying debt, but if you do look at us having 200 graduates per year, certainly a large portion of those graduates will have debt. The current bill doesn't mandate that money be available every year for tuition loan reimbursement. It says an award must be conditioned on the availability of money for that program. My understanding was that these funds were to come out of the profit from the student loan program. It must be from the interest on the loan, and it's in excess of those funds every year. I'm sure varies from year to year, and certainly if we were to set up this kind of program, we'd have to let the nurses know that this was not a guaranteed thing. Also, it doesn't have to be. You can say it can be up to $2,000 a year. I'm sure most nurses would be thankful for any amount of money that they would receive to help them pay off the loan. This program doesn't apply to nurses that have received their education outside of Alaska, not just those that have received it inside the state. So it isn't actually a forgiveness thing. It is a payment towards the loan payment itself. If you have any other questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Yeah, Pat, this is Dyson. I guess how much of an incentive do you think this $2,000 a year loan forgiveness, do you think that's going to make any difference to either people continuing their nursing education or staying in Alaska or staying in a rural community?
Well, I know that a couple of years ago, I was at a meeting with you with some public health nurses, and they were saying that if they had the tuition loan reimbursement, they could afford to become a public health nurse rather than having to stay here in Anchorage and work in a hospital because of the pay difference. So I think definitely it would allow nurses to have more flexibility in where what kind of settings they work in. And this bill allows the Board of Nursing to set up some criteria for who could receive those loans, and certainly we would want priority for those students that don't already have. Some of the employers will have a loan repayment program for the people they employ, and those people would not be qualified for this. And so maybe then the big hospitals would have less, the smaller hospitals would be able to compete with the bigger hospitals that are able to afford that.
Thank you. Other questions for Patricia? Thanks for the work you're doing. Go now to Homer. Virginia Worthwine. Did I get that right, Virginia? Virginia Worthwine in Homer, can you hear us? Have a look at the mute button on your mic. All right, we'll come back to Virginia if she's there. Laura Wilkie, can you hear us, Laura? Yeah, I'm sorry. Identify yourself, please.
Can you hear me? This is Virginia.
Oh, yeah. We got you loud and clear, Virginia.
Oh, okay. I appreciate the opportunity to present and bring to Chairman Dyson and the members of the Senate. As a worker, not working here in Homer, I'm always concerned about providing skilled staffing for our facility. If someone calls in sick or wants to go on vacation, frequently we can't even staff the ICU, the ER, or the labor and delivery unit. And we do see that any second woman in labor or an ICU admission will just throw the wrench into the staffing. Because we're census driven, we can never afford to staff for what might walk in the door. So I'm sure, you know, everyone involved with small hospitals knows this problem. So if we project the increase in vacancy rates and with the increasing and sustained nursing shortage, and especially affecting the rural or remote communities, I do feel strongly that this bill will keep nurses in Alaska and could offer a nursing student the opportunity to stay in school or register for school if they knew they were even going to be getting only $2,000 back, which seems like a drop in the bucket. Thinking back, I've been a nurse for 22 years, and thinking back on how much my education cost, and I graduated in 84, I can see that it does seem almost futile. That $2,000 seems like so little, and I would just encourage us to keep it, it's something. And as the baby boomers are aging, and with the aging workforce, and you see the averages of the age of the nurses, I can see on a personal level, the population is affected on a very personal level. The hospital, of course, is affected with the expense of traveling nurses, and I just see this as a very critical issue. And thank you. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you. And thank you for the work you do. Laura Wilkie? All right. I'm going to set this bill aside today so that we can have the SB 184 at least presented to us today. Laura.
My name is Laura Wilkie. I've been waiting a couple hours to testify, so don't go away yet, please.
All right. Can you give us your testimony concisely, please?
Yes, I will. I am a registered nurse, and I'm a new registered nurse. I just graduated last summer. As soon as I turned my tassel at graduation, a job offer was placed in my hand, and I immediately went to work at South Peninsula Hospital in Homer as a trainee, and Virginia Worthwine is a colleague of mine. Eventually, I was hired permanently to fill a labor and delivery position, and I also work on a medical surgical unit. I won't talk about the nursing shortage. I think you know there is one. However, for me personally, I've got $38,000 to repay for my education, and I'm currently doing that, and it's quite a drain on me. And I have an option to pay this loan off quickly, and part of that is I can go become a traveling nurse, and it's something I'm considering doing. I would leave the state and get my loans paid off probably within a couple of years. Every nursing journal that I pick up, there are enticements to go out and earn up to $100,000 in 6 months for becoming a traveling nurse at some desperate hospital somewhere. The irony of it is the hospital that I work at brings in traveling nurses. So something needs to be done to address this problem. And, you know, like Jenny said, $2,000 a year is a drop in the bucket, but it's also a statement that our legislature cares about the residents of our state. Nurses are the first line providers of care. We're the eyes and ears for the doctors. We work 12-hour shifts, and we're there by the patient's bedside, you know, as much as we possibly can. And you need us, and we want to work here, but there's no incentive. And, you know, I'm a nurse because I want to be a nurse, and I will be a nurse no matter what, but not everybody is as dedicated as that, and let's face it, we can make some pretty good money as being a nurse. And I just like to see you, to show your support for the health of Alaskans. Overtime's not an issue, we can't work every day. It's just kind of a crazy problem, and I think that you can take a small step towards solving it. It's an important problem. We need more nurses in this state. So I hope you'll consider this bill. I don't really think it's going to set off a snowball effect in having every person, you know, run down and ask for money to repay their student loans. I think we need to look at the current issue that this bill is dealing with, and not what might potentially happen down the road with more, you know, other people asking for forgiveness of student loans. I think we need to concentrate on this issue for this bill, and I thank you so much for hearing me.
Well, thank you, Laura. I'm glad we've got you, and stay, and I hope your tribe increases. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to set aside a bill. Part of the reason is Dan Barron's disappeared, and I wanted to get to the bottom of the fiscal note.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You betcha. Betty? We need to be out of here at least 5 minutes.
We'll be very brief.
In order to let them set up for another meeting that may have some interest. Yeah, but I wanted you to be able to present it. Thank you for your patience.
It wouldn't take very long for the bill to be presented, and I wanted to say thank you for hearing the bill. I think there's two people, if they're still online, to testify, and I was wondering if we just briefly give you the overview of the bill, maybe they might be able to at least be able to speak to it. They might not be able to come back. There is no fiscal note on this bill, and It's very self-explanatory. I'll let Richard just briefly go through why we have the change in the CS. In the original bill, we have another CS.
Yeah, and do you want, which bill do you want us to have before us?
The CS.
You should have the CS.
Okay, the G version.
Is it G?
Yes, F.
It's only been one.
F version.
All right, so I've got two. I've got the...
Should be version F.
Now, I've got the G and the F. Which one do you want?
F is a later date.
The G would be the...
Oh, okay.
You want us to have the F version?
Please.
All right, we'll adopt the F version as our working document. Go ahead.
Okay, for the record, my name is Richard Benavides. I'm staff to Senator Davis here, and I just wanted to go over quickly the changes in the CS from the sponsor substitute. In the title, we changed hospital's duty to provide same-sex staff to right to choose the sex of hospital staff providing intimate care. And on line 6 of page 1, we changed, again, same-sex staff to right to select staff, and then we added duties of staff. Also in that section on line 8, the sponsor substitutes the same sex, so we've changed that on lines 9 and 10 to read who is the sex that the patient requests. Uh-huh. And if you go to page 2, we've added a provision in the document to document in the patient's record any occurrences when a person of the sex that the opposite choice of the patient's doesn't provide the care, or if an unlicensed staff member provides the care, then that has to be documented in the patient's record. Let me know if I'm going too fast. Also on page 2 of line 14, there's a provision that allows a person who is of the opposite sex to enter those areas if it's necessary only in an emergency, and again, that would be documented in the patient's record. And line 19 adds a provision to exempt a hospital if compliance would adversely affect patient treatment. However, once again, a psychiatrist would have to document that in the patient's record. Also, the difference between the sponsor substitute and the CS, we removed a provision that would have allowed staff to come to a patient's doorway and conduct business from there. What happened, if I may, in the change between the sponsor substitute and the CS is a couple of things inadvertently got removed from our original version, so we wanted to place those things back in there. So that's the quick down and dirty CS version there.
All right. Thank you. All right, off-net, Andrea Schmuck. Can you hear us, Andrea?
You ready?
Yes.
Okay, my name is Andrea Schmuck, and I'm co-chair of the Alaska Mental Health Board and chair of the Advocacy Committee of the Alaska Mental Health Board and the Alaska Board on Addictions and Alcohol, as well as an individual recovered from mental illness. I'm here representing the Alaska Mental Health Board support for Senate Bill 184, which is gender choice and intimate care, or a bill that gives individuals the right to request the sex of the staff person who is providing intimate care. In the final report of the President's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health in Goal 2, page 9, states, in this transformed system, consumers' rights will be protected and enhanced. This is just that sort of bill that will enhance the rights of individuals who are hospitalized because of a diagnosis of mental illness. This is an important issue for individuals diagnosed with mental illness when you understand the historical perspective on the impact of sexual abuse on children and adults, whether they are male or female. In the 1990s, there was one issue about the use of restraints and seclusion that actually was being brought forward by two parallel paths that were emerging at the same time. Overwhelming support by the mental health consumer movement and advocates caught the attention of providers, commissions, and mental health authorities, and finally Congress. What happened was that through the efforts of the investigative reporters exposing how children were being traumatized by the use of seclusion and restraint in children's inpatient services, many times these children came out of these settings with more problems than when they went in, and especially the children who had histories of sexual abuse already.
and by the efforts of also adult women who were sexually abused as children and then being re-traumatized by the use of restraints in psychiatric hospitals and experiencing flashbacks to the sexual abuse as a result of the restraints. We need to look at the gender issue as an extension of not only being re-traumatized by the use of restraints, but also as a result of sexual abuse as children or as an adult, that not having gender choice also re-traumatizes individuals who have been sexually abused as children or adults. And we now must also recognize that this is not just a woman's issue, but since investigative reporting out of Boston regarding the sexual abuse of young boys by priests, the male sexual abuse issue has surfaced. In transforming mental health care in Alaska to recovery as its outcome, and in order to protect and enhance the rights of patients in inpatient settings, whether they're in ATI or a Providence psychiatric unit or North Star or other hospital beds, we need to look at this seriously and support the enhancement of the rights of patients in this regard by supporting legislation that includes this gender choice and intimate care, which is Senate Bill 184, as one way to eliminate re-traumatizing individuals who have been traumatized by sexual abuse. Thank you.
No, thank you, Andre. All right, to the folks that are in Anchorage, I have three of you there. We need to shut down this hearing in 4 minutes, so I'll let you pick who speaks. I am sorry that we've gotten constrained by time, and we certainly will give you another chance to speak to this, and or you can send in written testimony and we'll get it to all the committee members. So in Anchorage, who would like to speak first?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dorrance Paula. I support the passing of Senate Bill 184. In 1992, the legislative body in the general sort of way directed psychiatric facilities to produce a grievance procedure for their patients. Most did, most of little things like due process, a reasonable due process, emergency grievance procedures, written replies, etc. I believe this issue will be revisited by the legislature next year. Historically, there's never been a strong point of mental institutions anywhere, psychiatric facilities, to guarantee patient rights. Patient rights have traditionally come from the legislature and the court. Some of the major patient right organizations have brought this issue to their board of directors. They voted to support the gender choice bill. They are the voice of several hundred of their members. Disability law stated in their opinion that patients have a legal right to gender choice. Dr. Aaron Wolf, a psychiatrist with 30 years experience treating children and adults. A.N.F. Jennings, PhD, has an extensive knowledge and experience of patient trauma. They support a gender choice bill. I believe that the hospitals in the state that cannot provide the requested gender choice to the patient have an obligation to try to use the licensed staff. Defeating this bill is only a matter of convenience for the psychiatric institution. It's much more to the patient. It's about not being degraded or humiliated and maintaining some control over your life, your body. It's important and it's doable. And we ask the committee substitute Senate Bill 184 be passed. Thank you.
Thank you. I've got a minute and a half for one more person in Anchorage.
Good afternoon, Senator Dyson and committee members. This is Ron Adler, CEO of API, testifying on behalf of the department's position. I will be extremely brief with 2 points. Point number one, the department was not favorable to this legislation last year and continues this opposition. The department believes these issues are best resolved in policy and procedure rather than legislation. In working collaboratively with the Alaska Mental Health Board, various stakeholders in the hospital industry and their respective governing board, change happens in a positive manner. Point number two, the department in consultation with the Department of Law does not support any legislation which mandates specific information not related to the patient's medical treatment to be included in the patient medical record. In doing so, the legislation provides a clear pathway for potential litigants over non-adherence to a non-clinical issue. That's it, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, Ron, thank you for that. And really raises some issue that we will explore more in depth the next time we take this up. And so, thank you for your patience. And
you're welcome.
And Faith, we'll catch you next time.
May I just say one word to
yes.
Ron while he's there?
Yes, sir.
The last statement that you made, I would like for you to put that in writing to me, because I see nowhere in the bill to support what you just said at the end of your statement.
Sure, I'd be glad to put this in writing.
All right.
Would you like me to just address this to Senator Dyson?
I want you to address it to him as well as to me.
And also let us know who it is in the Department of Law that has weighed in on this issue. All right. Thank you all.
Okay.
Good work today. And there'll be no meeting Wednesday or Friday.
Okay.